People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. More than 50,000 people in Canada have died as a result of toxic drug poisoning since 2016. Each year, August 31st is International Overdose Awareness Day. It's a global movement that began in Australia more than 20 years ago. The goal is to bring attention to issues related to drug toxicity, to remember those who have lost their lives, and to move the conversation forward about solutions to bring an end to the harm caused by the toxic drug poisoning crisis. Events were held around the island to mark the occasion, including in Nanaimo, Victoria, and the Comox Valley. Today on the show, we'll focus mainly on a pair of speakers from an event in Parksville. We'll hear the story of Greg Heminger. He shared how he developed and recovered from an opioid addiction. Now, Heminger works on a project called Tailgate Toolkit. It aims to help people in the construction industry guard against harms from mental health and substance use issues. Heminger was one of the keynote speakers at an event in Parksville's Community Park. It was organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team and Moms Stop the Harm. A heads up, certain parts of Greg Heminger's story could be difficult to listen to, as he also shares the stories of some of the loved ones he's lost.
I'm the program coordinator with the Tailgate Toolkit in the Lower Mainland. We have regional coordinators in every health region across the province. I guess what makes me unlike any other coordinator is I'm 7.5 years removed from an opioid addiction, which should have taken my life. Quite frankly, why it didn't take my life is because of people like yourselves. People are educated about harm reduction. My late fiance, Shanna, she saved my life because of a naloxone kit. A firefighter who actually I went to high school with, it turns out, saved my life in a bathroom stall at Haney Place Mall at one point. And my last toxic drug poisoning, someone I'll never be able to thank, who just happened to have a naloxone kit on them, saw my prone body outside of a district 42 school board building, and saw me there and saved my life. And I'll never be able to thank that man or woman. I wish I really could. But it's people like you who take interest and care enough about your fellow individual and your fellow community member who are the reason why I am here talking to you today, why I am a proud stepfather today, why I am making something of my life today and hopefully doing some good in my life today. So thank you so much. And for anyone else who's just here because you're curious, thank you as well for your curiosity. As I've grown older, I've learned that nothing impresses me less than certainty. As I evolved through the years and I learned new things through experiences and seeing people around me suffer, I just always want to be better. And I went back to school, like, my background isn't your prototypical, you know, I didn't come from an abused home. I don't have generational trauma. Quite frankly, I had quite an easy childhood. I came from a loving upper middle class family. I did really well in school. I did really well in sports. I went to university straight out of high school. I got my degree in 3.5 years. Around that time, I'd always been encouraged to pursue creative writing, as I'd won a national creative writing competition when I was 6 years old, so it was always something that I could do pretty well. And I started writing screenplays. I sold my first screenplay a week after I got my degree in social culture and media studies, and my life seemed to be set, right? I had experimented with drugs through my teen years, but where I came from, there was kind of like two rules of thumb, right? No crack, no heroin. Those are just the no-nos. I'd never seen heroin. The word alone terrified me. I remember my father telling me once upon a time, if you ever get mixed up in that, you're done. You may as well kill yourself. And those words would come back to haunt him and me. Anyways, my life was off to a good start. I was making more money than I do today. You know, in the early 2000s, I was at the New York Film Festival premiering my first feature film at 22 years old, and things from the outside were seemingly successful, and they were. Me and my partner had settled down. We were actually raising her niece, who came from a broken home where drug issues were a problem, and it was kind of decided upon that we were the stable family that could raise this little girl, and we were happy to do so. So, and she gave us so much joy, and I was very proud of that. Unfortunately, a couple years into selling multiple screenplays and directing my second feature film, I got into a serious car accident. I broke my ribs, I broke my collarbone, I fractured my shoulder, I broke my back, and I had a serious concussion and brain bleed. I went to my family doctor, who I'd known my entire life. And at this point, mid-2000s, the word OxyContin wasn't part of the lexicon. And he prescribed me pills. And I didn't know the difference between a painkiller and an anti-inflammatory, to be quite honest. So I took it, not thinking anything of it. And I did so. And I probably got a little bit loose with it, you know, probably taking more than I probably should have. I just excused myself. I have a high tolerance, but I'm not that guy. I'm a successful guy. I'm a filmmaker. I'm, you know, look at my 401k. I'm doing pretty well. I'm not problematic. I can get away with this, right? And it was a year and a half into me taking these pills that I had no idea what they were when I was hanging out in my friend's basement. And we're watching a show on HBO called Eastbound and Down. I'll never forget this moment. And I didn't think anything of it. I indiscriminately took my bottle of pills out of my pocket. And I took a couple of OxyContin. And he said, "Greg, what are you taking?" And I thought nothing of it. I threw the pill bottle to him. And he looked. And all of a sudden, this guy who was never serious, ever. Like, he had this real, like, wave of seriousness wash over his face, and he said, "Greg, you're taking synthetic heroin." And I'll never forget that moment, because my stomach dropped, my heart started beating really fast, and in that moment I realized a lot of things over the last year and a half started making sense. There was a reason why I was waking up in the middle of the night in cold sweats, feeling like I was coming out of my skin, feeling like I was having convulsions, almost having seizures. There's a reason why I felt like not myself every 4 hours, and I couldn't be seen by anyone I knew because they would think something was wrong with me if I hadn't taken a pill. And it was at that moment that I had to put up my flair, right? I had an upper middle class family. I had the support of a beautiful girl who wasn't a drug user. I didn't drink at this point in my life. None of that. I had this family. I could have gone for that support and said, "Hey, I mistakenly have fallen into something that I didn't bargain for." But pride, but my dad's words about, if you ever get mixed up in that, you may as well kill yourself, rained down upon me. And then arrogance also washed upon me, thinking, yeah, I'm not like them. I'll be okay. I can deal with this. I really wish I would have cut it off at that point. Because a decade later, I was 125 pounds. I was living on the streets. As I've shared with you, I had died 3 times clinically. And my life was in ruins. And all it would have taken is reaching out. But the stigma is so real. And I share that because I'm going to take a sip of water right now. I've done over 300 talks in almost 4 years, and my mouth never gets dry when talking about any subject. But when I broach this subject, I automatically look out into this crowd and I feel less than. When I'm talking usually at construction sites or at tech schools, I feel less than, because I think they look at me as dirty because I'm a heroin addict, that I'm a fentanyl addict. Worse yet, at events like this, even though I should know better, I think some of you have lost your loved ones, and I feel so guilty about that. To this day, because I know I wasn't better than them. And the survivor's remorse was something that really kept me in addiction between 2010 and 2018, and I still struggle with it. And I'm still trying to think I'm good enough. Because so many people who are better than me didn't come out of this crisis. You know, my fiance was one of those people. Most beautiful girl I've ever seen, to the point that when people saw me and her together, they didn't know why she was with me. She was funny, smart. She hadn't ever prostituted her morality. She was always honest, and I wasn't. The only difference between me and her was that I utilized harm reduction because I was so far into my addiction by the time I had met her and we'd become a couple and got engaged that I was just done lying. It was just like when people ask me, "Hey, Greg, how are you?" I'd look them in the eye and be like, "You can see. I can't lie anymore." And the irony of that is, you know, from 2005 to 2010 with my previous partner, I lied every day of my life. No one knew I had an addiction for the first 5 years of serious OxyContin addiction. I lied to my partner who I lived every day with. And when that day came where I couldn't no longer lie and I had to go to the treatment, my first failed treatment center, she felt so offended by those lies that I had kept that secret from her because of that embarrassment. Right now, the irony is I talked to everyone for a living about the thing that I almost died, the secret I tried to almost died protecting. But later on, when it got really bad and my fiance, you know, didn't make it through the storm, it was simply the fact that through our relationship, she was noticing things in the last year or two of our relationship where she was noticing swelling develop on her body, different things popping up that were really weird. And I would beg her to go to the emergency department, but she refused to do so because she had been there before one time. And for this girl who was beautiful and loved and proud, and she didn't want to go through it again because, as she told me, she had been dehumanized in that emergency department and she didn't ever want to go through that again. Now, I finally did get the help, thankfully. However, she never did. And I was actually 3 months into my recovery when my dad showed up at a second stage recovery house to tell me that Shannon had passed away. And she didn't die of a toxic drug poisoning, actually. She died of MRSA, MRSA, an infection. And that was the swelling that I had noticed for the previous year. But the stigma of going to an emergency department and getting it checked out, she couldn't fathom. And it killed her because it went unchecked. And that is, and that won't go down in the stats. The stats are boggling as they may, but the incidental deaths, someone like Shanna, never gets noticed. And I wasn't smarter or stronger than her. I'm 7.5 years removed from my addiction only because harm reduction acted as not my safety net, but as my trampoline to recovery. Okay. Every person in addiction has 10 minutes every day. Where if you could get to them with the proper supports in place, the proper infrastructure logistically to get them the help that they need, they would get that help. And there's a good chance that they would be successful. However, it's so hard to do that. I know myself. I booked my room in a detox center 6 months before I actually had the courage to put one foot in the front of the other and actually get there. In those 6 months, it was naloxone, it was safe supply, it was harm reduction, it was safe injection sites, it was drug checking, it was apps, it was all of these things that kept me alive. Because that's the ball game. We need to keep people alive long enough until everything aligns so they can have the day that I had on January 16th to get to that detox center. That's the ball game.
You're listening to People First Radio. We've been hearing from Greg Heminger. He was one of the speakers at an event in Parksville held August 31st to mark International Overdose Awareness Day. The event was organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team, a group with a mandate to address the toxic drug crisis. It was organized in partnership with Moms Stop the Harm, an advocacy group founded by mothers who have had children die as a result of toxic drugs. Heminger works on a program called Tailgate Toolkit, which aims to address mental health and substance use issues within the trades. He was speaking about that work and also about his own experiences with opioid addiction and recovery. Let's get you back to his presentation.
We are fooled into believing that this crisis only exists on Main and Hastings or Pandora in Victoria, and that simply isn't the case. And we trot out the media trots out the same file footage over and over again of the person who, quite frankly, looked like me in the last days of my addiction. And that's not always who we're losing, to be quite honest. The fact of the matter is, around half the people we are losing are gainfully employed. Of those people, 53% are in construction, trades, and transport. People in those industries are three times more likely to die of toxic drug poisoning than any other industry. The second would be sales. Having said that, as shocking as those numbers are, I don't think they really do justice to the real numbers, because I have talked to people on the streets, right? I've talked to people who have lost loved ones, and so many of them are unemployed by the time of their death, but they come from those industries, but because of certain circumstances, they find themselves unemployed. I've talked to so many men in treatment centers who come from that industry, and the thing they tell me over and over again is they have real pride in being still the breadwinner in their family. And when they lose that ability to provide for their family, they lose their self-worth. I know what that's like. I know what that's like, because in the depths of my addiction, I lost my self-worth too. And the reasoning was a bit different. The reasoning why I lost my self-worth had to do with, no matter what your addiction is, what you go through in life, you'd like to hold certain values near and dear to your heart. You'd like to be an honest person. You'd like to not steal from anyone. You'd like to feel that you're a decent human being, right? And when your actions are incongruent with your values, that's when self-hatred begins, right? And I can guarantee you, I've never hated anyone 10% of what I hated myself in those moments, when the things that I held near and dear to my heart as who I am as a human being were being completely, I was being a complete hypocrite about, and I couldn't own up to those standards that I had set for myself. And self-loathing is a real dangerous place, because at that point you start stop caring if you live or if you die. And it's a really scary place. And for a lot of these men, when they lose the ability to provide for their family because their body is breaking down, well, what do, right? That's a horrible feeling. They work through it. However, their body keeps deteriorating, and they have to medicate that in some shape, form, or fashion. And this cyclical, right, vicious circle begins where, you know, they're breaking down. It's one or the other. They keep working through it, but then they keep self-medicating until it's not functional anymore, and they completely fall out of their profession, and they end up in a place of shame, right? And then they become, you know, you end up in the shadows of society, in the corners of society where I ended up. The other thing we hear again and again is a simple refrain of, we work hard, we play hard in the industry. And that's a badge of honor for especially men. And this is a male-dominated industry. We work hard, we play hard, right? I work my 50 hours, my 60 hours, whatever it may be. And then we party with the boys on the weekend, and then we hit it on Monday, and we work twice as hard. And there's pride in that, and that's a badge of courage. However, with the toxic drug crisis that we're all aware of, that becomes a real dangerous place. Because when the boys are out drinking and maybe they want to level out, you know, the drinks with a line of cocaine, they find fentanyl in that cocaine. I was lucky enough to, as you guys know, as I mentioned, I have a background in film, and I swore off ever doing film again in my life. But I was invited by the Chilliwack Community Action Team and Mountainside Harm Reduction to take part in a documentary they're doing on drug checking. And I felt it was a real important documentary to make. And I said, I'm in. And I did it. And I was horrified, you know, because even what I understood as a dangerous place 7.5 years ago has gotten so much more dangerous. As was mentioned, the benzo epidemic within the drugs, the inability for people to be saved by naloxone, I'm drawing a complete blank right now. Trank is showing up now at a very alarming rate that it's wiped out communities down south. These are things, and the stuff that is showing up now in drugs is ridiculous. We have this idea that the person that I was at the end of my addiction is the person most at risk. However, I really am not, because I was aware of harm reduction. Right? I was aware of all the remedies that I could take to protect myself to some degree. But it's the weekend warrior, that person in the construction industry, who is most at risk, because they're still hiding it from everyone else in a lot of cases, or they're doing one drug and they're getting another. Right? And you may have noticed I have not used the term overdose once while I've talked to you. And I want to ask all of you, when I say the term overdose, what are the first words that come to mind? Perfect. Thank you. But it's very true, right? And that's simply a misnomer for what's going on in today's society. That is not what was happening. I'm going to tell a story about my best friend. In 2002, his name was Warren David. I actually got reacquainted with his little sister recently, so I really want to talk about him today. He was my best friend, and he was a very successful young man. I was 22, he was 24. He had already owned a home. He was actually housing his mother free in his basement. He had worked his way up, actually, as a construction worker. He was already a mortgage broker as well as a realtor. He was doing really well for himself. He was a very gregarious personality. Everyone loved Warren. Life at the party. He would show up every party, you know, case of Molson under the arm, and occasionally a flap of cocaine in his pocket, right? Not too often, but every 5-6 weeks or so, he would do a bit of cocaine. And we were out one night in June of 2022, and we were at our local, you know, watering hole, and I was the designated driver. It was kind of past the point already for me at 22 where I wasn't drinking, and I just was hanging out with my friends. And I could kind of tell this was one of those nights where maybe Warren was using, just because his jaw was moving a lot and he was going quite often to the bathroom. And as the night progressed, I noticed he started looking really gaunt. He was very pale. His face was starting to droop. And I grew concerned enough at about 1:30 in the morning where I said, hey, we had another two friends still in the bar. There was four of us. But I said, Warren, can we go outside? I think you need some water. Let's wait for, you know, Louie and Chad, and let's just get some water and some air outside. And he agreed to do so. So we went outside and we talked for a while and waited till our friends came out of the bar. When they did, I dropped them off first, and Warren was my last stop in the night. And once we got to his house, I noticed that he had fallen asleep in my passenger seat. I gave him a bit of a shove, and he was non-responsive. I did it again, and still nothing. But that wasn't too crazy in my early 20s, where a friend may pass out from drinking. So I went around the back of the car to the passenger side. I gave him another shake, and another shake, and another shake, and another. And I realized he was cold, and he wasn't breathing. And I've dealt with a lot of things in my life, but nothing will prepare you for knocking on your best friend's mother's door and saying, your son's in my car and he's not breathing. And at the time, we had no idea why. Warren had... I took a lot of guilt on. I had night terrors for the next week and a half. I was really like, it was just a horrible, horrible time wondering how this could happen. How I had my best friend's life in my hands and I fumbled it because I didn't get him to a hospital when I knew something was wrong. When I saw he wasn't looking right. After his funeral, another week went by and we got the autopsy and he had died of a heroin overdose. And in 2022, none of us had ever even seen heroin. It was completely foreign to us, and I know Warren hadn't done heroin. So we checked around. And what we didn't realize is Warren had a regular cocaine dealer. And on this day, he went to a dealer that he wasn't familiar with. And that dealer gave him cocaine, and there was just a tiny bit of heroin in that cocaine. And it ended his life, a successful young man at 24 years old. Now, Warren David wasn't a drug addict, nor would I say that he overdosed. He was victim of a toxic drug poisoning. And the sad thing is, everyone in the community in which I grew up, which is Maple Ridge, at that time, was well aware of what happened to Warren. And it was seen as such a tragedy. How could this happen? Like, what a fluke. How unlucky was Warren? Yet today, this is happening 6 times a day in our province and no one bats an eye. And we just want to relegate it to homelessness. And until we separate the homelessness crisis from the toxic drug poisoning crisis, we're not getting anywhere. Because they are not one and the same. And we need to realize that.
This is People First Radio. We've been hearing from Greg Heminger. He was speaking Sunday, August 31st in Parksville's Community Park at an event to mark International Overdose Awareness Day. The event was organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team in partnership with Moms Stop the Harm. Heminger works on a project called Tailgate Toolkit, which aims to educate those working in the trades about mental health and substance use issues. At the event, he spoke about his work and about his own experiences with opioid addiction and recovery.
I've been very blessed. I am the product, and my recovery is the product of harm reduction. And I already spoke about how it got me there, but it was also in that first year of my recovery where harm reduction saved my life. Because in a treatment center, there's about a 90% success rate. So tell me why 90% of people can survive that 8 weeks in a treatment center. However, there's a 93% recidivism rate once they leave that treatment center for the first year. Anyone have an answer for that? I'll say it. Because there's connection in those treatment centers. It's about a bunch of like-minded people moving in a similar direction. There's that embedded support, right? And I know that because I really believe my life was saved first by being put directly on OAT, which in my case was methadone. Despite the stigma, when I left a treatment center, I was put directly on methadone, right? And what that did is it allowed me to produce dopamine again, because I talked to so many people in their first year of recovery who can't hack it because they feel this tremendous void and this inability to feel joy, right? And I used it very responsibly. I had people who were on my team who communicated with me regularly. I had a great addictions doctor who had a plan for when 18 months into my recovery, I could slowly come off of the methadone until I didn't feel anything. And to be quite frank, if I was on methadone still today, so what? So what? Because I know in the last 6 months of my methadone, I was a productive human being, right? And I felt no different than I did today. And there was no shame in it. And too often the recovery community puts the shame on top of it, where they don't feel like they can take their clean time as a badge of honor, and it's BS. It strictly is. too often we're made to feel that way. And methadone saved my life. My doctor, Dr. Beckett, six whatever years later, still calls me every 3 months to check in on me, and we have a friendship, right? And he's a beautiful human being because he humanized me, and he cared about my interests and my family and knew their names, and he took that time to humanize me when I was at my lowest, right? And he told me something so important. He said, Greg, you were someone through the first 30 some odd years of your life was really used to winning, and you haven't had a win in so long. You just need some wins. And I don't know how many other people in addiction can speak to that, right? That little bit of human kindness, that's a win. Establishing a relationship with a person you've lost contact with, that's a win. Going back to school, which I only could do because of methadone and having that stability, that was a win. It told me, like, I can still pull grades. I'm not broken. I'm okay. This didn't ruin me. I'm still a capable human being. And all those things I hated myself for, that morality is slowly starting to come back to me, right? And it made me a decent human being again. And it was the most important thing that ever happened to me. It is such an important part of one's recovery. So please, the stigma involved, because when we speak of harm reduction, it's not just about staying alive, as much as that is the most important thing, because everyone has a chance. Everyone has a chance if you wake up tomorrow, because that might be the day. But it also was the catalyst to get me to positive things in my life that made me feel like a human being again. So that stigma that exists needs to stop. The other thing that was so important, I just talked about that success that you have within a treatment center, because there's a sense of community. And I went to a second stage treatment house, as I told you guys, and I was at a fork in a road. No one would have bet on me making it out. You know, when I lost Shanna 3 months into my recovery, everyone said, even my dad, I remember, oh God, the sound he made when he told me Shanna died was one of just like fear. He was like, I had my boy back for 3 months and I'm going to lose him because he's not getting through this. And somehow I did, because I had community in a second stage treatment house. And when I left that second stage treatment house, I went straight back to, it was called the Maybridge Treatment Center Alumni Group, because that's the treatment center I went through, was Maybridge Treatment Center. And a group of guys started a group and a meeting twice a week, one in the treatment center and a second one outside the treatment center, for people in the treatment center and people who would come out, to give them that connection once they had left. And I went there, and I was so nervous, I didn't know why I was there. And I sat in the back of the room, and I was like quiet for the first two sessions. And it was after the second meeting when an old short dude named Marlon came up to me, and he said, hey, young fella, how you doing? You got a phone number. And the man in me, the same male kind of like aesthetic that gets construction workers into trouble, thought, why does this dude want my phone number? Like, this is creepy. Like, I don't want to give you my phone number, dude. But that's so stupid, because he's a really nice guy reaching out, trying to do me this favor, and I don't want to give my phone number because I thought he was hitting on me or something. But I gave him that phone number, and he gave me his phone number. And the next morning, I got a text and said, hey, Greg, it's Marlon. How you doing this morning? And I got to be honest, us men are so messed up. I talk to construction workers about this all the time. It was so hard for me to text back to him, I'm good, Marlon. How are you? I felt dirty, you know? But I did it. And then the messages kept coming. And the more meetings I went, more people came up and asked for my phone number. And next thing you know, I'm up at 5 a.m. and there's 7 of these messages. And I'm like, this is a lot of work, but it's really cool, right? And it took me about a month to realize what these men were doing, right? And then I realized they were touching base with me every day and giving me a sense of community. Because while it's really hard to make that first call to say, I'm not doing well, if you get someone early in the morning, ask them how they're doing, and then maybe at 7 a.m. it's great. But at 10 a.m. they run into some sort of problem, their girlfriend's cheating on them, whatever that may be, it's a lot easier to reach back out after people have established that contact and say, hey, I know at 7 a.m. I said it was all right, but shit has just gone sideways and I need someone to talk to. And then I started noticing a real crazy thing. Within this group, there was this community of men, and they were different races, different ages. They even cheered for different sports teams, which was really weird. But they had the closest of friendships that I've ever witnessed. And there was this joy I'd never seen human beings have for another person's success. They wouldn't chest thump about their own success, but they'd be like, Marlon would come up to me and be like, hey, did you hear what Steve did? Steve just got a job here. Did you hear what he just bought? Like, there was this real uncommon joy that I'd never seen in my life before addiction among my peers, where people were way happier for their fellow friends' success than their own. And everyone really looked out for each other. And I'm not as close with that group today in terms of, because I'm very busy, but we still have those text message threads and we still celebrate each other's victories. And they still are the, you know, when I was, you mentioned it, I want to mention it, but when I won a BC Healthcare Award, they were celebrating it because I'm one of their own and they were so happy for me. And I've never experienced that with my own friends, right? That is the type of community that I want us to build on construction sites, right? Because this is predominantly a male-dominated crisis in a lot of ways. It's like 80% men dying. And it just so happens the construction trades and transport industries are like 90% male. And I ask the question at every talk, why is it men are dying so disproportionately? And I put the microphone out, and no one says shit. And I say, thank you for making my point. We don't talk about our trauma. We don't talk about our pain. We don't talk about our grief. And that's so crazy because this group of men that I've met, 30, 40 deep, we have these beautiful, tight bonds. And we may not come from the same church, be of the same age or the same skin color, but we have shared our deepest fears with one another, our losses, our grief with one another. And there is such love and closeness when you can do that with another human being that those bonds are something that you can never break. So that's something I really try to support, because it's not a utopic view that doesn't exist. And I was very differential. Like, I was very oppositional in my stance during my addiction. I didn't think that type of society existed anymore. I thought capitalism is a failed social experiment. Everyone is about themselves, stepping on one another to the top, and no one gives a shit about one another. And then I found this group of men, very blue collar in a lot of ways, and they had such sensitivity and care for one another. And I thought, this can be achieved. And this is the way that we can open up and have consensus and conversation with one another, where we don't have to hide if we're struggling with pain or mental health issues that we all are suffering from, because this time is not an easy time for any of us, right? And it's not just the people dealing with addictions. It's the people like my parents who told me painfully, I had to hear it, that every day they had to wait for the inevitability of my demise. That phone call that told them that I wasn't going to wake up, that I was gone. How many people are going to a construction site today and are putting others in risk because their mind is thinking about their son or daughter or partner? That's what we're dealing with, right? But what I have noticed is when I tell my truth, the truth that I hid for 7 years to strangers on a construction site, right? Things change. At the start of a talk, I ask people, how many of you have been affected by the opioid crisis? Secondhand or firsthand? And I think we can all raise our hands and be honest in this room, right? But about 10% of hands would go up in those rooms initially. Now, 3.5 years later, it's about 50%. However, after the end of 45 minutes, I would always see 10 or so people wait till the room cleared to come up and talk to me about how their life has been affected by it. And those 10 people were always from the group that didn't put up their hands at the start of the talk. It's just about being transparent, right? And being honest that we're all affected by this. And as much as I've been affected as an addict, I was affected more by loving an addict. That is the hardest thing, that helplessness. And for the people here, especially Mom Stop the Harm, I have more respect for you than anyone on earth. We all work very hard to delay the inevitability or the worst thing from happening in our lives. But once the worst thing happens to an individual in life, we kind of give up. The worst has already happened. And what can be worse than losing a child? Nothing. I lost a partner. It's not losing a child. I would never compare it. But here you are, working day and night to make sure another mother and another father doesn't feel and go through what you did. And I respect that so much, and I thank you so much for it. And I do my small part, but I'll never be able to do as much as y'all. And I just thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Greg Heminger speaking at an event marking International Overdose Awareness Day, Sunday, August 31st, in Parksville's Community Park. The event was organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team and Moms Stop the Harm. Coming up, we'll hear from a nurse who is working to address the harms of the toxic drug poisoning crisis.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
International Overdose Awareness Day started in Australia more than 20 years ago. The goal of the movement is to remember loved ones lost and to create conversations around solutions to the issues created by toxic drug poisoning. Today on the program, we're bringing you speakers from an event held to mark the day in Parksville. Organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team and Mom Stop the Harm, it took place prior to a vigil held at Parksville Community Park. Corey Ranger is president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association. He spoke at the event.
Today I want to do four things. I want to share a story from my work. I want to share what the data tells us. I want to name why policies are not aligned with evidence or ethics, and I want to leave you with some actions that you can take today. But before I get started, I want to offer a couple of disclaimers. First, the content that I'm talking about today is uncomfortable, but we still need to talk about it. Next, the data is not simply data. You'll be hard-pressed to find someone who is not directly impacted by this prolonged public health emergency. So let's be kind to each other. Next, I'm not going to try to change anyone's minds. That's not my job here today. What I truly want for everyone is to be armed with the tools that they need to critically appraise policy and media so that you can make your own informed decisions. My commitment is to speak truth with compassion, to acknowledge fears and misunderstandings, and to always come back to the message, we can all be safe. My name is Corey. I've been a nurse for 14 years. And I've worked in harm reduction for 13 years. I've worked in homeless encampments. I've worked in overdose prevention services. I've worked in prescribed alternatives programs. I've responded to several hundred overdoses myself. This is my naloxone kit. And we've been together for the last 10 years. Thanks. I also serve as president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association, a national nurse-led organization and specialty interest member with the Canadian Nurses Association. We advocate for policies that save lives. We advocate for evidence-based decision-making. And we elevate the voices of those most affected by this emergency. We see every day how evidence-based interventions work and how harmful policies cost lives. So for my story, I'm going to talk about the beginning of the pandemic. In 2020, in the early pandemic, I was working in a large encampment in Victoria called Topaz Park. There were over 200 tents. Services were stretched thin. One week, the drug supply changed. It was check week of April of 2020. And all of a sudden, people were overdosing, but the naloxone wasn't working the same way that we expected it to. It was taking multiple doses. Service providers were really scared. People were telling me, oh, this person, they took 8 doses of naloxone to be revived. What we later learned was that benzodiazepines had infiltrated the market. It wasn't just a fentanyl poisoning crisis. It isn't an opioid emergency. It is a drug poisoning emergency. People are not afforded agency of choice. They do not have consumer rights. If I finish this event and I decide I want to have a beer, I can go to the liquor store and I can decide what beer, what content, what alcohol percentage, and make that informed decision as an adult. Could you imagine if there was a small possibility that my beer had fentanyl in it? Could you imagine the public outrage that there would be if there was even a 3% chance that my beer wasn't beer, but it was actually fentanyl? Futures Thinking asks us, what happens if we keep doing nothing? And what happens if we build policies that actually keep people safe? Now, folks have already talked about some of the statistics, and so I'm not going to go too far into that. But BC declared a public health emergency in April of 2016. We've lost thousands of people. It's been 9 years, 4 months, and 14 days exactly. And 17,102 British Columbians have died at the hands of this crisis. Right here on Vancouver Island, the coroner tells us that the impact is among the worst in the province. In 2024, Island Health had a rate of 49 deaths per 100,000 people, far higher than the BC average of 41 and second only to Northern Health. And it's not abstract for Parksville either. In 2025 so far, up to June of 2025, 163 people have died on the island and six of them were here in the local Oceanside Health area. Across this country, we grieve thousands. This crisis is here in our homes and our neighborhoods, but it's also preventable. Effective policymaking and program development requires a sound understanding of the problem itself. Who is affected? Who's disproportionately affected? What is driving the deaths? These problem definitions are largely taken for granted by politicians. But as we will discuss, the policies and decisions being made by those in power do not reflect these realities. So let's answer that question. First, we know who's most affected. And it's everyone. Indeed, while we have a distorted image in our minds of who is the face of this crisis, the truth is that nearly half of all toxic drug deaths happen inside of a private residence. While the media portrays this crisis as one synonymous with homelessness, people aged 30 to 59 who live in private residences make up the bulk of deaths. It is the leading cause of accidental deaths more than any other cause combined, more than homicide, suicide, and motor vehicle collisions combined. We know what works. The evidence is clear. Supervised consumption services and overdose prevention sites save lives. Opioid agonist treatment, methadone, Suboxone, Kadian, they actually reduce mortality. They provide a protective backbone so that if people do relapse, if they do get a bad batch, that they can stay alive. Safer supply reduces reliance on the toxic, unregulated drug market. There are over 110 peer-reviewed studies on safe supply that all point to the same outcomes. Drug checking gives people the tools to survive. Housing and Indigenous-led healing creates conditions of safety. But our policies are going backwards. Right now, we're seeing a love affair with involuntary care, which we actually know from the evidence increases relapse and post-discharge death. We're hearing about municipalities wanting to shut down supervised consumption services, which will only force people into riskier spaces. We have a prime minister that is tabling Bill C-2, the Strong Borders Act, which only doubles down on failed interdiction policies. Leadership should mean funding what works, not what polls well. And so I'd like to read a letter that the Harm Reduction Nurses Association wrote to the Prime Minister of Canada to honor International Overdose Awareness Day. To the Right Honorable Mark Carney, Prime Minister of Canada, on the brink of another International Overdose Awareness Day, we're still being asked to mourn while politicians debate the lives of people who use drugs and whether they're worth saving. Tens of thousands of Canadians have died from preventable drug poisonings. Countless families are shattered. Direct care teams are exhausted. Indigenous, racialized, disabled, and 2S LGBTQIA and low-income communities bear an unfair burden of suffering as their healthcare needs are moralized for political gain. We do not have an awareness problem. Across Canada, HRNA nurses work directly with people who use drugs and have witnessed the evolution of the toxic drug supply and the devastating consequences of Canada's drug laws. We are the health professionals providing life-saving care, conducting outreach in alleys and parks, and absorbing waves of grief as we lose community members. Between 2016 and 2024, at least 52,544 Canadians have died preventable deaths during this crisis. But in recent years, we've made some progress. We've made measurable progress, scaling up innovative harm reduction approaches, expanding access to safe supply and supervised consumption, and challenging long-entrenched policies like criminalization. Today, however, we are in an era of moral panic, where policy is driven by rhetoric instead of evidence. Attacks on harm reduction are attacks on bodily autonomy, undermining the very principles of public health and human dignity that keep people alive. At the federal level, the government has advanced Bill C-2, an outdated xenophobic drug interdiction policy that prioritizes border theatrics over evidence and human rights. At the provincial level, involuntary detention, coercive medical interventions, cuts to low barrier, not-for-profit and harm reduction programs, and forced displacement of unhoused people drive up risk for more deaths because there are fewer spaces for people to use drugs. A strong body of evidence demonstrates that involuntary treatment is ineffective for preventing relapse and carries a high probability for harm, including death. And at the municipal level, stigmatizing political statements incite moral panic, undermine public health guidance, and restrict access to life-saving services. Strong leadership is not about cracking down on the vulnerable. It is, in your own words and commitments upon election, to care for them. The courageous leader stands up for Canadian sovereignty, our ability to make decisions for ourselves, not against marginalized communities. Leadership means funding what is evidence-based, not what polls well. In the context of this drug poisoning crisis, this means redirecting funding from carceral approaches and investing in harm reduction. HRNA members have attended more than a decade of memorials and vigils and done all we can to raise public awareness. We have data, coroner's reports, and decades of evidence from harm reduction, housing first, safe supply, and supervised consumption. What is lacking is political courage. International Overdose Awareness Day is not just a time to remember, it's a time to act. So why don't our policies match the evidence? Part of that answer is because of misinformation and disinformation. Fear-based myths, like nurses being at risk just by touching fentanyl, they are false, but they travel fast. Everyone should know the difference between myths and disinformation. Everybody should know how to spot and challenge myths and disinformation, but we don't, because it's not something that gets the attention it needs. This is something I focus heavily on in my master's. I actually am studying the policy implications of myths and disinformation and moral panic. Does everyone know that there's a difference between myths and disinformation? Do you know what the difference is? Misinformation is unintentional. Most people can't actually critically appraise the media. We trust the news. Disinformation is intentional. Disinformation has to be created. It has to be amplified, and someone benefits from it. And when misinformation and disinformation contribute to public fear, we see a moral panic arise. And we are in an era of moral panic right now. People who use drugs are treated as villains. They're treated as pariah. They're treated as people that we can't even go near because fentanyl smoke might get us. This is part of a larger process of dehumanization, where we can then build consensus for policies that harm people because they're a risk to the general public. Social media plays a significant role, and these are powerful forces. These have contributed to the recriminalization of people who use drugs. This is what contributed to harm reduction vending machines being pulled out of hospitals overnight last year. This is the basis for Canada's drug laws. When fear drives policy, families get hurt, and our family deserves nuance, not panic, safety, not stigma. So what would it take to turn the tide? We need to center lived and living expertise. The concept of nothing about us without us is not just for equity, it's because they are the experts in their needs and what there is actually going to work. We need to ground decisions in public health and human rights. We need to abandon the criminal moral model. And we need to look at this from both a health and justice lens. And we need to build equity into every policy. Who's most disproportionately impacted, then let's prioritize their care needs. And for each of us here, there are tangible steps that you can take today. Who has a naloxone kit on them? Raise your hand. So every one of you next year, when you come to IOAD, you can raise your hand because it's really easy to get the training. I have kits right here as well. I'll even show you how to use them. When you carry a naloxone kit, you're actually signaling to everybody else around you, I don't know if you use drugs, but if you do, I care about you. You deserve to live, and I'm going to take care of you. It is a form of solidarity and community care. Have hard but loving conversations with family and friends. There are a lot of people who don't understand this crisis. There are a lot of people who don't know what's driving this emergency. It takes time and compassion to bring people back. If we just throw data and evidence back at them, we will always have this divisiveness. So we have to make space for people to come back. Write letters to the editor. If you see stigmatizing language being used in media, say something about it. If you see an article about harm reduction, but the journalist uses a photo of a dirty needle in a puddle, call them up and say, hey, you can use a different picture, you know. These are all ways that framing creates an image in our mind of what this crisis is. And so we can challenge mis- and disinformation at every possible angle. And lastly, ask politicians to back evidence, not optics. Ask them, how will your policy solution keep people safe? How will your policy solution get people housed? How will this stop the deaths? Imagine Parksville in 2030. No one dies from overdose. Every block has access to naloxone. Every community has safe spaces, and no one is criminalized for surviving. That's the future we can build together. Thank you.
Corey Ranger is president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association. He was speaking at an event Sunday, August 31st, in Parksville's Community Park to mark International Overdose Awareness Day. It was organized by the Oceanside Community Action Team in partnership with Moms Stop the Harm. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.